the 50 years since the Stonewall riots, a lot has happened in the art world. Lesbian, gay, bi, queer, trans, and non-binary people have all come out into the world and created marvelous art depicting their authentic selves.
A massive two-venue exhibition and book, Art After Stonewall, takes a look at the art, artists, and activists that engaged with LGBTQ+ politics to unapologetically portray same-sex and trans desire while shattering the gender binary.
Today, the show's curator, art historian Jonathan Weinberg, joins us to marvel at these amazing artists who changed the world in the two decades after Stonewall. From Fred McDara's iconic 1969 photo, Celebration After Riots Outside the Stonewall Inn, to Willem Olander and Grand Fury's iconic graphic design of a pink triangle paired with the expression, silence equals death.
Listen as we chat with Jonathan about lesbian art, about vaginas, from Judy Chicago's Dinner Party to T.A. Carine's Cunt Coloring Book.
Gay art couples who took the everyday and transformed it into magic.
Art as a response to the AIDS crisis and the impact of the NEA4.
I'm Fausto Fernos.
I'm Mark Fillion.
And this is Feast of Fun. Feast of Fun is made possible because of the support of fierce, fabulous people like you. Become a member and listen to 14 years of amazing podcasts at feastoffun.com/plus. Or put a tip in our tip jar and make a one-time donation at feastoffun.com/donate. Thank you for your support.
Hello?
Hi, is this Jonathan Weinberg?
Yes.
Hi, Jonathan. This is Fausto Fernos.
And Mark Fillion from Feast of Fun. How are you today?
Great. And can you hear me? Is this working all right?
This sounds great.
Good.
Now, the category is Art After Stonewall. Congratulations on the book, Art After Stonewall.
Yeah, thank you very much.
And it is very exciting.
And the exhibit, yes. Too.
Yeah. I don't know if I should be doing this, but I have a second book that probably will interest you out right now called Peer Groups, Peer Groups, Art and Sex Along the New York Waterfront. I have two books out at the same time. And actually the two subjects overlap, and there are several works in art after Stonewall that deal with the piers in the 70s in New York. And as you probably know, that was a big center of gay sexual cruising, but also there were a lot of art made on the piers. So it's kind of an exciting time.
Well, we've been watching Pose, and one thing that strikes me is how cheap it was to live in New York City in the years following the Stonewall riots. And it sort of allowed people, had a lot of free time, had, you know, certainly were struggling economically, but you had this very blossoming community of artists, of pioneers, of people living on the margins and really making some extraordinary visual and performance and music work that changed the world.
Well, I'm a painter as well as an art historian, and I lived in the East Village and in the early 80s and grew up in the Village. So I can attest that it was amazing. I was just passing the apartment that I lived in the other day, which was down in Soho, and I think my rent was $250.
How much?
$250 a month. So it wasn't a great apartment. It had a bathtub in the kitchen, and the toilet was literally out in the hallway. But still, it was, you know, right now.
Yeah, I stayed in one of those apartments that had the bathtub was the kitchen / was the bathroom / was where you washed your clothes.
Exactly. It was very convenient. Everything was close at hand. So, but I mean, it was amazingly cheap. And of course, but the other side of it, the city was bankrupt. So that's why you had these, the waterfront had these abandoned buildings that people were doing all this stuff in, you know, because they weren't being used by shipping anymore. So there was a lot of, you know, people were getting mugged, and there were a lot of downsides to it. But on the other hand, is you could afford things, and it was, you know, there was all these possibilities.
In the late 80s and early 90s, where I came of age, getting an airplane ticket was like $75. You went to stay with friends on the weekend and you performed the clubs or the art galleries, and then you went back home. So people from all around the country were traveling to New York just to be part of this creative mecca.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, that's definitely true. I mean, what you're saying is that kind of ability to live very cheaply. I mean, the East Village would not have happened. All these galleries that opened, that's sort of the second half of the show. That's the Gray Art Gallery. There's a section called Things Are Queer, and you have artists like Keith Haring and Ethel Eichelberger, the old Pyramid Club. Well, the Pyramid is still there, I think, but it's not the same as it was in the early 80s. And these and artists owned the galleries. I mean, they were incredibly cheap to set up, at least initially, and people could do all this experimentation because they could afford it. And there was this sort of sense at the time that you could do things. You could put works up on the wall. A bunch of artists, David Vernerovich, Mike Bidlow, several of the artists in the show, Louise Frangella, took over a pier at the end of Canal Street, Pier 34, and they filled it with art and painted on the walls and graffitied and, again, all for free. You know, there was no electricity, but it was an incredible thing to do in the summer. So there was this ability to sort of experiment.
You're one of the few people in the world that can pronounce David Wojnarowicz's name properly.
I have to tell you, the secret is we all call him David because I probably not. I think it's Wojnarowicz is how you're supposed to pronounce it, but I fear I probably am not pronouncing it right.
Now, when you set out to make this book an exhibition, Art After Stonewall, and I imagine that you know a lot of amazing people, artists, did some of the drag queens from the Pyramid Club, like RuPaul, say, why didn't you include me?
So far, no. You know, to tell you the truth, I have not. But those are not the people who have purchased. And I have to say, we have quite a wonderful array of people earlier on. I mean, sort of the precursors. So we have the Coquettes in the show. Mm-hmm. I mentioned Ethel Eichelberger, Varbal. These are, and the fantastic Charles Ludlam, and there's an incredible painting by David Hockney of Divine. So I don't think you could fault us for leaving that aspect of it.
But how did you begin to narrow it down? Because I imagine you have just an ocean of very well-known artists, as well as very, you know, people are still relatively obscure. And you have this giant responsibility in the 50-year anniversary of the Stonewall riots to sort of put into almost a time capsule the experience, the human experience of all these people.
Well, I that's a really good point. And I should say that the show, we've been working on the show for 7 years. Wow. I was the lead curator, and I was asked by the Columbus Museum of Art 7 years ago to put together a show. They wanted me to do some kind of a gay show. At that point, we weren't actually thinking of the 50th anniversary and all the different thinking and possibilities, and time went on. And then suddenly I thought, oh my goodness, you know, the 50th anniversary. I have to say that I was so disappointed with the 45th anniversary that people had done so little around that. And I said, no, we've got to do more. And then we had many different curators who were involved with it. Originally Melissa Wolf, Lisa Dent, there were different actually women curators who were part of the original plan. And then also we had an advisory committee with people like Margaret Ventress who are on it, and Flavia Rando and Chris Reed. So we reached out to many people to get advice. I should also say that the show is the first 20 years. So it's 1969 to 1989. And that also helped limit some of the people, because if we were going to do the whole 50 years, we already have 160 artists in the show. It would have been much more difficult, I think, to sort of figure things out. We also were really wanted it to be a mix of famous artists with artists that should be famous. So obviously there are people like Andy Warhol and Keith Haring. But we also have wonderful artists that maybe you won't know as well as Michaela Griffo or T. Corinne. I mean, these are artists that I've known for a long time, but other people aren't as aware of their work. And I think that's a problem.
Were there any disagreements on who to include and not include?
You know, by and large, I don't remember getting to huge arguments so much. I mean, I think there was there was worry from Columbus that we kept adding, you know, it was more, you know, people would have great ideas and we'd keep adding and adding and they keep saying, really? And then we would sort of circle around it by saying, oh, well, you know, this is just ephemera we're adding, it's a poster there, as if that would make a difference. Like it would take up the same, you know, still take up the same amount of,
we tried. Well, we wanting you to spill the tea, you know, Jonathan, like, was she like, you know, somebody wanted Jasper Johns's flag and you're like, that is not about gay people. Category is queer art for queer artists. That is an American flag.
Right. Well, thank you for saying that in a certain way, because that is another really important point, is that one of the ideas of the show. So one of the things that we did in terms of organizing the show is around seven themes. Right. And the first theme is about coming out. Right. Coming out of the closet. And one of the things I really like to focus on here, and I work with, but let me mention the last two curators I work with, Drew Sawyer and Tyler Kahn, who both were at the time part of Columbus's curating team. But one of the things that we really focused on was the idea of visibility, right? Mm-hmm. So what you're saying is absolutely true. I mean, I adore Jasper John's work, but we didn't want to include work that was about, decoding the work so much, right? Mm-hmm. We wanted to include work that was showing you things. So much of the way that gay art has been talked about in its history has been as if it were a secret that the art historian or the curator has to discover the homosexual subject matter, right? It's some kind of a private language. But in so many of the works in the show, the artist is saying, you know, we're queer, get used to it idea. In fact, that's one of that's the final section. It's called We're Here, right? And that first section is all about sort of there's a great Keith Haring work that he did for the National Coming Out Day, in which a kind of androgynous figure is jumping out and sort of dancing out a door, right, out into the, it's for National Coming Out Day. So it makes coming out seem like it's a wonderful thing. And finally, I was going to say that a lot of the ways in which queer people were depicted in the media in 1969, when they were depicted, was always as if it were a sad, upsetting struggle, right? Mm-hmm. And so many of the images in the show, including the famous coming out poster that Peter Huger did the photograph for, everybody looks happy and joyous, and they're rushing down the street, and they're ready to announce their fabulous queerness. I mean, the Coquettes are full of fun, or Charles Ludlam, the Theater of the Ridiculous. There's a sense of joy, or if not joy, anger, but not of this sort of self-pitying, suicidal upset, right?
A lot of artists are discouraged from being sentimental in their work because they see it as cheap or manipulative, and because it takes away the audience's ability to feel things for themselves.
Yes, I think that's right. Or just self-hating, right? I mean, I can't help but cry when I watch the movie The Boys and the Band. I mean, it's a wonderful movie. And remember, that movie out, well, the play was just at around the time of Stonewall, but the movie was out in, I think, 1970. But, you know, you go to that movie and yes, it's poignant, but you want to, you almost want to commit suicide after seeing it. Right?
Yeah, if I don't want to kill myself, I want to kill them.
Yeah. Right?
But, you know, the interesting thing about Boys in the Band as a movie is that it gives us a window into what life was like for the people who didn't hang out at the Stonewall Inn, and for much of the reality of upper middle class gays in New York City at the time of the Stonewall riots. The way they socialized was at each other's homes.
Yeah. And remember, the idea of coming out, people forget this, but prior to the 60s, to come out meant not to come out in public so much, but to come out to other gay people, and it morphed into this political notion. And also, look, I'm 61 and seeing The Boys in the Band, I don't want to, you know, I love that movie, Action, and I love those people. And I I'm self-hating in so many ways. I can tell you, I'm Jewish and I'm gay. I'm
filled with guilt. You're not Southern, too, are you?
No. New Yorker.
My Jewish friend says the most self-hating Jewish gay is the Southern Jewish gay.
Yes, that's an unusual combo, right? But I'm just saying that the closet is so powerful force in the way we look at the world. But not, people tend to think of the closet as being in or out. And actually, every day you have to come out of the closet in a way. Like if you talk to the cable company on the phone, you say, my husband, right? And they don't know. They don't know necessarily you're gay or not. So, and also, a point that we really need to make is that for different people, it's a different experience. People can have the privilege to come out, but other people can't. As you say, in the South, if you live in a little town in the South where it can be dangerous, you can be killed if you come out. And that's still true for a lot of people in the United States. And certainly it's true through most of the places in the world, right? Mm. So it's, we always have to keep in mind. There's another wonderful work in the show by Robert Hilber that is, if you want to know some of the inside stories. Mm-hmm. So it's an open closet. It looks like a closet until you get very close to it and you realize that's a carefully sculpted piece. And it doesn't have a door. And the cool thing about it, or the problem with it, is that you, in order to install it, you have to literally install it in the wall like you would install a regular closet. And for various reasons, we didn't think we'd be able to do it at the Gray Art Gallery. And Robert Gober is an incredibly famous artist, but so generous in his studio, worked with us. And it turned out that there was a kind of space right in the beginning of the gallery that was used for coats. It really was like a closet already. Oh, wow. And we went to Robert and we said, can you somehow fit it into that space? And his people did. And he loved it because it really is something that is like, it's there, right, where you come into the museum, but you don't really notice it until you really look at it and you realize, goodness, this is strange. It's kind of pink. And it does, the closer you look at it, the more it doesn't actually look like the closet. And he's kind of making a comment, both is he saying, now there's no door on the closet because everybody's out? Or is he saying that you can go in and out of the closet? It's a very mysterious, kind of surreal piece, I think.
Let's talk about Fred McNerara's photograph. When people think about the Stonewall riots, they think about Fred's celebration after riots outside Stonewall Inn, which has about 10 young people standing outside the Stonewall Inn with big smiles on their faces. And this was just taken days after the Stonewall riots sort of had wrapped up.
Well, it's so important and so smart to mention that, because first of all, one of the mysteries or difficulties of this whole thing is that there aren't pictures of the actual riot, right? We have to remind people that night of June 28th, when, as Tommy Lanigan Schmidt, he's one of the people in that photograph. He's an artist. So there was an actual artist at Stonewall, also, and he was he's in that photograph. He was in the bar. He tells people that what he remembers about that night was the smell of lighter fluid. That's what he said, that it smelled like. Whenever he thinks of Stonewall, he thinks of the smell of lighter fluid. But he also said that the reason the riot happened is because people just wanted to dance with each other. And that sort of was what was behind. And finally, the police come in to raid this bar like they've done over and over again. And instead of getting paid off or the people in the bar going along quietly, they resisted. And people need to remember, as you see in this picture, that it isn't upper middle class or preppy young men who were in that bar, but they were people of color. They were people who were drag queens and trans and working class. And this is something that Tommy talks about in his writings. He wrote a memoir about that period 20 years later in a little broadside that we give out actually at the exhibit. Anyway, Tommy does wonderful sculptures that he makes in foil and gold. You mentioned, I don't know, did you mention religion? Because Tommy is Catholic and he makes these palaces, and he made this little monument that is like a little Statue of Liberty that is a kind of monument to Stonewall.
But it's interesting to look at this photograph because all these people look like it's the first pride parade. They're all happy. They're all like posing for the camera, like tourists. Like, this is the place where those riots happen. And already just days after the riots, every queer person in the country that was aware of them understood that there was a mind shift in the way we were thinking about ourselves and our sexuality and our gender identities.
Yeah. Well, two things I have to say, because I learned this, is that the people from the 70s, particularly, they don't like calling it a parade. They like calling them marches, because they feel that, you know, it's in a sense, what you're saying, I think, is both true and not true, because it is the spirit that they're giving off, the joy they're giving off, which creates that feeling that, you know, what a lot of people like to point out, historians point out, is that there have been many similar riots before Stonewall. But Stonewall really took, because so many artists and people like this decided to remember it and to celebrate it. And that convinced people in a certain way that things had changed. So it's a kind of process, right? So, for example, the other famous photograph of that Peter Huchar took, that was made over into the poster coming out, in which all the people are running down the street, all these beautiful young people. I mean, they're all white and middle class. They look more white. They look like hippies, actually. But, you know, that one's a little more kind of less diverse. But again, it's this sense of joy, like they're taking over the street, right? Mm-hmm. And most people, I think, when they look at that picture, think it's a document, right? But in fact, Jim Farratt got together. He was a lover of Peter's at that time. And he got the people from the Gay Liberation Force, a group of people, together. And they posed that picture early in the morning on the streets of New York. So it looked like they had taken over the streets.
Mm. Well, now, if you look at the architecture, if you go to 53 Christopher Street on Google Maps, and you look at the aerial view of Greenwich Village and the neighborhood around the Stonewall Inn, you can quickly see why it was such a bad idea for the police to target the Stonewall Inn, because you had these triangular little parks where it was really easy to run away from the police and to create a mob that could pile up. And a lot of people aren't aware of this, but in New York City, all those fences around those little parks sort of popped up as a response to the Stonewall riots. So a lot of the architecture not only permitted the Stonewall riots to be successful, but also change as a result, because they didn't want people protesting in New York City.
Oh, that's interesting. So one thing is that we want people to keep in mind, at least in terms of the art show, Art After Stonewall, is that it's much more about the art than it is the particular history of all this.
But I just wanted to throw that out, that because I read about that in a book about architecture in New York City, and I thought that was such a fascinating thing.
Mm-hmm. Oh, no, I think what you're saying is absolutely true, because it brings me back to when I got my PhD in art history, we spent a lot of time looking at France in the 19th century. And, you know, of course, that the French Revolution and all these sort of revolutionary moments in France in the 19th century were a result of the tiny little streets that you can easily barricade, right? Mm-hmm. And so in the later part of the 19th century, they built all those huge avenues. One of the reasons they did that was to stop people from putting barricades across the street. So it's absolutely true that I think the other thing about the police is that they just didn't expect it, right? They didn't think that the queers were going to resist, because they, in their mind, you know, we were just easy pickings, right? We were just going to, you know, skulk away. We were either too embarrassed, or we weren't strong enough. All those kinds of stereotypes, I think, were part of it, too, right?
Well, it's very telling about our society, because there's the intersection of the mob who controlled the bars and the police, right?
Yes.
And we're living under both their thumbs, and at the same time, we're like, fuck you to both of you.
Well, Flavia Rando and Michello Griffo, Flavia is a wonderful art historian, and actually there's a wonderful drawing of her in the show. But Michello Griffo is one of the artists, you know, a wonderful painting. But they told me that they protested in front of a lesbian bar because it was mafia owned. And I was like, really? I mean, you know, like you realize the courage of people back then. A few days ago, somebody came up to me when I was doing a book signing, and they talked about the the piers and the gay men at the piers. And they said, oh, it was so wonderful back then that there was a safe space for gay men to go to. You're laughing. And I said, no, it wasn't a safe space. It was a dangerous place. Mm. You could be mugged. You could fall into the water, but people did it anyway. Right. Mm-hmm. And look at these pictures of people being happy and cheerful. That doesn't mean that at any point, and this used to happen at Christopher Street in the 70s all the time, somebody would drive by and scream at them, faggot, or they would throw a rock, or they would come after people with a baseball bat. So these were not safe spaces. Mm. I think it's really important to keep that in mind. Or that's what they were trying to fight for. I mean, Stonewall in itself, you're right, it was owned by the mafia. Mm. So you might have been able to dance there, but it wasn't a safe space. And that's why they were so angry.
It's interesting in talking about safe spaces, how art galleries in the last 100 years transformed themselves from these sort of elitist institutions that were celebrating mostly very macho men. You think about like Pablo Picasso, right? And it's almost like the Dadaists and, you know, sort of spearheaded by Marcel Duchamp and later, you know, Jasper Johns and Robert Rauschenberg, Andy Warhol, Merce Cunningham, John Cage, all these gay couples that were really interested in the everyday objects and the nonsensical, that to transform the art galleries and art spaces into very queer, thriving community spaces. Can you talk a little bit more about that transformation? Because I'm really fascinated by it.
That's a really complicated question, right? Yeah. I mean, in some ways, of course, the artists that you're talking about, whether it's Johns or Rauschenberg, and I mean, this is a really complicated story. They did it in a kind of surreptitious way, right? They were polite about it, let's put it this way. I mean, people, it might have been what they call an open secret that they were gay. And often, many of my older gay friends who are artists talked about how the gay dealers, for example, wouldn't show paintings of naked men, right? So, you know, you started by talking about the Johns's flag. I mean, keep in mind that a lot of this work was interesting in the way in which it might have been representing homosexuality, but it didn't necessarily show naked bodies. Or if it did, as in Johns's Target, there's a penis, you could cover it up. You know, the Target has little boxes that can open and close. Mm. So again, the courage of these artists, but you really have to go to somebody like Andy Warhol, right, to get an artist who's really sort of being outrageous, right? And that's a bit different. And then what is the situation for lesbian artists and women artists? So it's not until the 70s that you get this really important lesbian show that Armie Hammond and various women put together in New York or at the Women's Building in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. And then so much of the art world ignored that work. It didn't really, it's still kind of ignored, right? So again, I think all this is very complicated. And that doesn't mean that, you know, I'm saying, oh my God, you know, this world is bad or that world is bad. But the other side of it is something which we need to be aware of, is just because you're a gay man doesn't mean that you might not be misogynistic, or if you're a lesbian, you might be transphobic, or you might not be so conscious about race. One of the things I like to say about this show is that it creates this wonderful sense of community, or many communities. But at any given point, a lot of the artists who are on the wall weren't speaking to each other. One of the great photographs in the show, there's a great photograph of Sylvia Rivera, who is a really important advocate for trans rights. And it's at the very moment when she is in this march denouncing people in the march because they are not allowing what she would call transvestites, that was the word they used, to go into certain spaces, or not standing up for the rights of trans people. So, you know, it's really complicated, they're different communities. But at the same time, I think you're also right that people are trying to change the world. They are trying to find new ways of being and acting, and art is a really important part of it. Not necessarily about changing people's minds from the outside, but keeping the spirit up through the struggle. There's one of the great pictures in the show is a painting by Alice Neal of Kate Millett, who wrote the famous book Sexual Politics. But people don't know, for example, that Kate Millett was a wonderful artist in her own right, and we have a major sculpture by Kate Millett. That painting, by the way, was on the cover of Time magazine. And this is interesting. Kate Millett at the time said that she didn't want to be on the cover, but she didn't want to be the face of women's liberation. Mm-hmm. She didn't think anybody should be the face of women's liberation. I think that's really interesting.
Can we talk about the artwork of Linda Bengelis, which is a really wonderful and unforgettable advertisement in art form? The artist, she greases herself up looking like a 1980s pole dancer, and she's holding a rock hard dildo, making herself look as if she's a transgender woman, right?
Right.
And that was just, I remember that causing such a scandal in the art world.
Right. That happened in 1974. Yeah. And it's actually, I believe, Linda Bengelis. But I mean, I'll tell you how she pronounces her name.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. I'm just always reading off of a book. So
No. Yeah. These names. So Linda, one of the things which we're very excited about in the show is not, and actually, if you read the labels, we don't go into a lot of about people's sexual identities, but Linda Bengelis identifies, I believe, as heterosexual. But one of the things we're really interested in is the way that the Stonewall moment changes the art world, and various artists are creating images that are influenced by what's going on in the LGBTQ world. And this is this famous moment where Linda Bengelis is sort of taking the phallus and making herself into this sort of outrageous image. That art form would not print that picture as a regular work of art in the magazine, but they, after much controversy, were willing to run it as an advertisement. So we put that in the show. It's a very famous image. But one thing almost nobody talks about is that this dildo that she's using is not the kind of dildo that straight people at the time would have, right? It's a double-headed dildo. It's either something that a man, a gay man or a lesbian would use, mostly, I think, gay men, right? And so that adoption of that, at the time she was lovers actually with Robert Morris, and there's an amazing poster where Robert Morris kind of wears this outfit that makes him look like a kind of leather man, with a helmet, and he looks very much like a kind of gay S&M figure. And he's again another straight artist who's kind of adopting the pose of queerness as a kind of avant-garde gesture. Now, what is the relationship between making art that is transgressive and living in a transgressive lifestyle? I think that's a very interesting aspect of it.
Well, someone like, there were so many straight allies in the art scene that were pushing the boundaries of art and sexuality. Someone like Vito Acconci, who identified as heterosexual, he did a work called Seedbed, where he claimed he masturbated under a temporary floor under the gallery where visitors could walk above and hear him speaking through a microphone. And he was like, I'm masturbating right now. So you could you were walking on top of a masturbating naked man underneath, the floorboards, which is wonderfully unnerving and wild.
Right. Well, we have a work by Acconci in the show, a video. We also have one by Adrian Piper. These are two again. How a particular artist in a way identifies isn't as important what the work is about. And in this video, Vito Acconci grabs at his naked body and tries to grow breasts, and he does all. It's actually, it's the most traditionally obscene work in the show. It's kind of still scandalizes me when I watch that, all the strange things that are going on in that video. And I was very fortunate for my book on the piers to be able to interview Vito Acconci, because he did a wonderful piece at the end of Pier 17 where he asked people to come in the middle of the night at 1 a.m. where he would whisper secrets in their ear that they could use to blackmail him with, again, what kind of secrets could he tell them, which are interesting, that I think very much, the whole idea of blackmailing people at the time was always related, or often made people think about being homosexual. Mm. So, and I talked to him about that. I asked him and he said, absolutely. He was thinking in those terms, and he was very good friends with the critic, John Perrault, who was gay and wrote some of the first writings about gay art and art forum. So that was really important part of the show.
Can we talk about vaginas as art? Judy Chicago's dinner plates, Georgia O'Keeffe's very vaginal paintings of flowers. But my favorite one is in your exhibition is T.A. Carine's Cunt Coloring Book.
Yes.
She takes drawings of vaginas that you can color in, including a vagina that looks like a golf course.
Well, I'm not quite sure about that description, but
I went in and started looking for it because I was like, this is T.A. Carine's Cunt Coloring Book was a zine. It was published really cheaply. It was sold in coffee shops, and you guys managed to get yourselves a copy of this thing. And I just think it's brilliant.
Listen, you can get a copy right now on Amazon. It's still available, I believe, or used to be. I was able to get a copy, just last year.
They're still original or reprint?
Well, what constitutes an original,
Like it's the pages are brown and it's, been sitting in somebody's attic for decades.
Yeah, it would be a first edition, but it's still, I think it's still being published. I mean, she died relatively young and of cancer, and she was just a wonderful person. T was not just a fantastic artist, but she was this great supporter of exhibitions and helping artists like Jeb and Kathy Cade to become photographers. So and she was really important in the magazine On Our Backs, which was one of the real dilemmas that women artists have who are trying to make erotic work for lesbians is how do you do that when so much of lesbian images, if you type lesbian now right into the internet, onto the internet in your web browser, up will come all this great porn, right? So how do you
or poetry,
right? how do you claim the female body for women? And so that's part of what some of the women artists are doing. And one of the things in our culture is that we really devalue female genitalia. I mean, we don't want to look at it. And that was a huge thing in the 70s. You can see in Barbara Hammer's wonderful film, Didactics, there's a moment in which the women are photographing their bodies, looking at something which they're told not to look at. And I just listened to an interview a few days ago, which on Terry Gross, of all things, we're discussing the subject of women masturbation and how it's still a taboo for women in television or in film to talk about masturbating.
Oh, yeah. It almost torpedoes Cyndi Lauper's career by doing that song She Bop.
Right. So we have this idea that it's a terrible, shameful thing. And the artists are saying, no, this is a beautiful thing. It's a wonderful thing. It's a source of power.
The AIDS crisis brought upon a huge challenge for not just these art galleries, but for the queer community in large cities like New York, in that it was devastating, not just in terms of people dying, but also in terms of estates and money being taken away from our community back into the heterosexual families of individuals who didn't leave strong wills and so on. And so what I thought was really interesting in my coming of age is how the rise and now the disappearing of gay and lesbian bookstores, where you had postcards by people like Keith Haring and Robert Mapplethorpe and Andre Serrano and, Madonna and Jean-Paul Basquiat and Andy Warhol, all these wonderful photographs and postcards and T-shirts that helped to fund the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force, ACT UP, and all these other very important groups.
Yeah. Well, I mean, AIDS is when we first conceived the exhibition, we were going to end on AIDS and activism. And that's one of the intersections of the show. And I have to say, the wonderful people at Visual AIDS, who we were talking to, like Alex Fialo and Nelson Santos, said, no, don't actually end on AIDS. I mean, that's their whole thing, right? My husband, Nicholas Bosch, I can put his name in, he works for AIDS Project New Haven. So we're so aware that the AIDS crisis is not over, right? We're still going on. Right? But on the other hand, we didn't want to have that idea sort of that you end on death. And yet, or illness, or even the struggle against that, that's why we end with "We're here." But at the same time, walking around the show, so many of the artists still should be alive. My best friend, Mark Lita, for example, has a wonderful piece in the show, this amazing watercolor of the Saint with Grace Jones. He died in 93. David Voronovich, Heath Herring. We can just go Mapplethorpe. We can just go on and on. And it's certainly one of the aspects. Of course, the other side of that was the amazing response of artists. And they realize
and Grand Fury with a silence equals death triangle. And, you know, I mean, how many ACT UP chapters around the country funded their operations just by selling those shirts?
Right. But let me make something really clear, because, oh, my God, that you talked about people getting mad at us because we screwed up on a label. Silence equals death actually predates Grand Fury. So there was a collective, some of the same people. Mm-hmm. Like Afram Finkelstein were part of the creation of Silence Equals Death and became part of Grand Fury. But they actually were a group that was formed exactly the same time as ACT UP. So that's the kind of thing the show kind of puts the record straight around. And so Silence Equals Death, you're right. I mean, and then they kept selling those shirts and those posters. But then right after that, then Grand Fury, which is a collective of graphic designers, including some of the people who worked on Silence Equals Death, continued and became the sort of agitprop, and we have many of their posters. And then the other side of it, the West Coast phenomenon, is the Names Project Quill, which I think is...
Well, yeah. Hold on a second. So are you saying that Grand Fury didn't design the Silence Equals Death poster and all these Wikipedia entries are wrong?
No, didn't. They didn't design it. No, and the catalog is clear. The catalog says it. It's something called the Silence Equals Death Collective designed it.
So they later became Grand Fury after the consequence of that.
Not the same people. A few of the same people.
I see.
And what makes it confusing for people and kind of wonderful is that these artists insisted on anonymity, because the whole point of the graphic design was to be about the design, not about the egos of various artists. But, you know, in retrospect, the people who designed the Science Equals Death poster wanted to be known that it was not, Grand Fury hadn't been formed yet. It's just a historical thing, you know. And that, you know, that's
very important. Thank you so much for clarifying that, because all through my life, like I even, you know, I went to art school at the University of Texas at Austin, and they brought people from Grand Fury to speak and talked about the making of that. And I always thought it was an unusual group of people, because, and also like sort of the Gorilla Girls, I don't know if you remember them.
Yes, yeah, they still exist.
There was this need for anonymity in these kind of art groups that were pushing the boundaries, that were being very aggressive politically to making, to fighting against the marginalization of queer people.
I mean, one of the things is, and it's true, because when you're part of these movements, you want to be recognized. I was just speaking to Jim Ferret a few days ago, and he was making the point that, you know, the Gay Liberation Force, for example, which is, you know, early days in the early 70s in New York, closed down, and they had spawned groups all across the country, and those groups continued, right? So often historians will say, well, the Gay Liberation Force, you know, ended in 1972, and then the GAA happens. But what about all the chapters that existed all over the country? They continued, right? So it's often depends on our context and where you live, and as you say, I could see how you could be in Grand Fury and you yourself, because that's not really what it was about at the time, right? Mm-hmm. You know, doing my book on the piers, one of the things I'm kind of obsessed with is which pier was which, where, what happened where. People didn't care. They just say, I'm going to the same piers. I'm going to have sex at the same piers. And I'm like, which, you know, was it pier 46? Was it pier 48? And I can tell you by the year what pier it was, or, you know, I can look at a photograph and tell you the date, how we become so obsessed with it. But most people didn't care, right? At the time, what was important was the message that was getting out there. And certainly the poster Science Equals Death continues. You can still, you know, you can probably still get a Science Equals Death T-shirt and people still wear it and people don't know. I mean, it's part of its power that people don't know it.
You know, the funny thing is I just saw a young gay man at the International Mr. Leather Competition conference here in Chicago wearing a Silence Equals Death T-shirt. And to me, it was very heartbreaking to see the original design being messed up. So they weren't using Futura Bold Condensed, and they were not using the scale of the pink triangle was the scale from, you know, it was a bigger pink triangle about the size of the human hand, and their pink triangle was more Hitler's World War II Germany concentration camp scale. And to me, it's so interesting that there's this market for still to this day, you know, of all this sort of queer art as merchandise.
Well, that's interesting. But on the other side of it, you know, what's so amazing about Grand Fury is the way that they follow the appropriation art idea. I mean, basically, so much of Grand Fury's method comes from Barbara Kruger and, you know, other kinds of method. And the idea is you do what you need to do, right? That I think that was definitely part of the graphic design at that moment. And if of course, they appropriated, several of the artists appropriated Robert Indiana's Love and remade that in different ways. Mm-hmm. There's one different image called Riot. Then Marlene McCarty, who was a member of Grand Fury, but is an artist in her own right, she made one called Fuck, which I think is kind of amazing because the story about Robert Indiana, you know, he was lovers with Ellsworth Kelly. And I heard the story, maybe it's not true, but is that originally he wanted it to say fuck, not love. Did you know that?
Oh, Robert Indiana, that famous L-O-V-E that's on postage stamps and it's sitting there in Philadelphia. He wanted it to say fuck, not love.
That's what I heard, but it could
be
a myth.
It's really amazing that like Barbara Kruger's Your Body is a Battleground, you go into, you know, I see people selling this off of grocery carts at pride parades next to like rainbow flags and boas. It is amazing to me that some of this art we're in love with it. It speaks too much, so much of the queer experience that we'll have this 100 years from now, still on T-shirts, bumper stickers, and whatever you know, future merchandise we'll be wearing at the then.
Right. But on the other hand, what's so cool about it is that when Barbara Kruger first started doing that work, people thought it was really ugly because she was using the most blandest kind of typeface. I mean, it looked like anti-graphic design, remember? And then it became suddenly looked so chic. Right. But at the time, she was originally an art director. So everything that she did was sort of against the rules. And then she went out of her way to use photographs that were in the public domain, which is different from Andy Warhol, because he actually got in trouble for stealing some of the images that he used. So anyway, I mean, this sort of idea of artists, you know, repurposing stuff because of, I mean, you think of the very names that we have. Queer is a repurposing of a word that was used against us, right? Yeah. And then we took that word and we turned it around and we turned it upside down and it became a word that means, that is a kind of idea of power to it. One thing we should mention is Marsha Johnson, Marsha P. Johnson, because she is, because you started out by talking about, you know, queer art and what is a queer artist. And I think of Marsha as being a kind of performance artist, if you will, or performer. Mm-hmm. And there are many pictures of her. And she, of course, was at Stonewall. And she was the subject of an Andy Warhol series called Ladies and Gentlemen. Mm-hmm. We have one of the prints from that series in the show at the Gray Art Gallery. That's a kind of weird, that's a kind of perfect example of how complicated everything is, because Warhol, when he decided to do that piece, it was suggested to him by an Italian dealer who really had a kind of awful idea. He said, I want pictures. Why don't you try, Andy? Why don't you do some pictures of really bad drag? You know, get some like men who are in drag. And Andy was like, supposedly said, oh, come on, I've done drag. We did drag already. We did that in the 60s. We don't need to do it again. But because it was a dealer or whatever, he said, okay. And he went to Bob Policello, you know, was his assistant, whatever. And Bob got dressed up in drag and he did a photograph of him and he said, oh my God, this looks so terrible. I'm not going to turn that into a picture. And then he gave Bob some money, Policello some money, and he went down to the bar on, I think it's on 44th Street, used to be along the waterfront, actually. I'm forgetting the name, but it was a big drag hangout. And that's where Marsha was. And he paid some other drag queens, or trans people, a few hundred dollars and brought them back to the factory. And they were photographed and posed. And then Warhol made those prints, which are kind of wonderful. But they're as far as I know, they're the only series of portraits that he did that he did not give the names of who the people were. When they were first shown, they were just called ladies and gentlemen. So nobody knew it was Marsha. You had to know Marsha to know who it was. And so it's a very weird project, right? In some ways, it was kind of transphobic. But her wonderful sense of joy and fabulousness comes through in the image. So it's kind of, I'm happy that it happened, right, in some kind of weird way. But the process is really kind of weird, right?
At the NEA 4, when conservatives in the federal government tried to destroy the National Endowment for the Arts, which at the time was like a microscopic amount of money per taxpayer to fund individual art projects and art galleries and spaces, from the opera to humble galleries in every community around the country. And part of it is like, conservative and corrupt politicians were using art funding as a way of holding on to political power. And the NEA 4, and so, you guys have Karen Finley in your exhibition, so I wanted to sort of wrap up talking about this. What was the impact?
Holly Hughes, Tim Miller, Karen Finley.
You know who the fourth one is?
I'm sorry.
John Fleck from Star Trek.
Oh my God. Really?
Yeah. He was a character actor on Star Trek.
Enterprise, right?
Enterprise and Voyager.
He played Sylvan.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay. Well, anyway, he's not in the show, I'm afraid.
But so what was the impact of the NEA4 on queer people and art galleries across the country?
Look, I do want to get a plug in here for Donna Ann McAdams, who took the photographs of these wonderful performance artists, because she's a perfect example of somebody who doesn't get credit. She's always taking photographs of one of a famous, wonderful artist. And she's a fantastic photographer. And because she's sort of, her ego isn't the focus. It's whoever the particular artist is that people don't focus on her. And she's an old friend. And
I recognize her name, because anytime you have a photo of Tim Miller or Holly Hughes or Karen Finley, it's Donna, Donna McAdams, right?
Donna Ann McAdams.
Yeah.
And she also the wonderful artist John Byrne, who was one of the first people to be diagnosed. I think at the time they called it GRID. And I knew him, and he died very early in the epidemic. And he's in the show. And everybody who knew him, we just adored him. He was such a beautiful man. And anyway, it was, this terrible time in which the culture wars, of course, Mapplethorpe too was at the center of it. I mean, what you have to say with these kinds of acts of censorship is that they don't work, at least initially. The particular artists who get singled out end up becoming more famous than they would have been. The most famous story of this is Jesse Helms insisting that everyone in the Senate look at Mapplethorpe's famous self-portrait with the bullwhip up his rear end. He literally sent that around so that every senator would look at that. Now, what artist wouldn't want, their work to be seen by every senator of the United States? So acts of censorship often misfire. On the other hand, what people don't realize is that the curators or the conservative people who often run institutions, that particular show gets seen, but the next time around, they just decide not to put the work on the wall. They won't get into this controversy. Nobody wants to risk losing their job or not getting a certain amount of money. So these acts of censorship, I think, do sometimes get the work out there in an interesting way. But on the other hand, they have a chilling effect going forward. And people say, you know, I there's a kind of thing that happens with art and doing shows. I've been doing this so long, is that you find yourself self-censoring in an interesting way. I often would be worried about things in the show, and I would say to my fellow curators, you know, I'm happy to show this, but are you okay with it? Because I don't want anybody to lose their job, right? And so that's an interesting problem all the way through, the way that censorship can, you can't really judge the effect that it's happening right at the time. Because as I say, there's often this publicity effect, right?
But do you think it pushed queer artists to look for more mainstream and more commercial venues? Like, I'm thinking about, you know, how theater companies like the Five Lesbian Brothers at the time, and, you know, Holly Hughes, and there was this very vibrant lesbian comedy touring scene that sort of became mainstream and, you know, gave rise to someone like Ellen DeGeneres and the Ellen DeGeneres mm-hmm. show. And for a lot of queer artists of that time period, there was a desire move on to Hollywood and to commercial places to tell their stories, because the art galleries no longer were a reliable place. And a lot of art galleries that we knew and love, that were spaces that were very rebellious and very playful and joyful, no longer exist.
The reality is that anybody who's part of this whole story has so many battle scars. I mean, there's so many ups and downs and moments when you break through, and then also people go, you know, just for probably every artist who has some kind of success, then there gets the point, oh, we've seen that, we've done that. I can't tell you, only a few years ago, people were telling me, oh God, you still do gay art history, or you do queer theory, that's over, that's finished. Why are you still doing that? Even when there had been hardly any shows, there was the sense, oh, well, that's done, right?
What happens to artists when their work never gets recognized, when they never make it into the mainstream?
You know, one of the things that I keep coming back to in a funny way in my life is that act of saving, you know, art. And of course, visual aids is so important in terms of recognizing what happens when an artist doesn't become famous, you know, and who's going to take care of their work. The visual aids is all about that. And that haunts me, I have to say, as a painter myself, who, you know, maybe hasn't broken through, you know, who's going to care about my work? And my other job is I'm curator at the Maurice Sendak Foundation. And, you know, Maurice is a hugely famous artist, so everybody takes care of his work. But he actually adored Mark Lita's work. Mark was one of his students.
Yes. Yeah. Where the wild things are.
Yeah. So when Mark was dying, Maurice bought some of his work, but, you know, there hasn't been a lot of attention to Mark's work. And I take care of Mark's estate, and Visual Aids is one of the places where you can see his work online. But it's a hard task, you know, and it seems to me that that's a task that art historians really should be focusing on. Is how can you save art? Anything you can do to save work. So Part of the reason I do shows like this, and I did this, do try to write these histories, is as an act of remembering, of saving, you know, because people's attention actually is so flighty, and something, you know, that's, and I'm you know, I'm very aware of that. It's a struggle, I think.
The internet is this kind of mixed bag, right? On one hand, it's helping LGBTQ artists and their fans and their audiences find each other. But on the other hand, it sort of takes us away from meeting each other in art galleries and art spaces face to face.
Well, there's when I did this a few years ago, I did a show around that Pier 34 moment when all these artists took over that building. And David and Mike Bidlow, David Voronarovich, put together this sort of manifesto, and they talked about taking over a building and, you know, this sort of guerrilla act of doing this. But one of the things, the piece ends with this idea that this could happen anywhere. Anyone could do this, right? But maybe you can't do it in New York where it's all gentrified, but maybe somebody can do it in Detroit. Right. So I think that things change. Right. There are always these, I think there are these moments of freedom, these moments when things open up But then, you know, people copy it and they lose, maybe they lose their freshness, edginess. But then, you know, young people find other things to do, other ways to open things up. And you sort of use history. I think you got to use history as a way of unmooring the present. Without sounding too pretentious, to me, that's one of the ideas of Walter Benjamin, which is that we shouldn't, we often use history as a way to shore up conservative ideas. You know, you go to the past and say, oh, this is the way it's always been. This, yeah, you know, marriage has always been this way. That's why it has to stay this way. But really, I think what history should be all about is going to the past and realizing that the past was different. Therefore, the future can be different, right? We can, if people did these things and they acted in this way and they had the courage to do this, well, then maybe we can have the courage to change things going forward. Maybe, you know, if we survive the AIDS epidemic, which is still going on, if we're surviving it, I should say.
Yeah, not everybody survived it.
Right. That's a good point. Of course, we can somehow keep going right through that. You're absolutely right.
What do you make of Jeff Koons's rabbit selling for $91 million, a new record for living artists? Some people are criticizing the way that art becomes this multi-million dollar enterprise as just a sneaky way of laundering money.
Well, that's a interesting question. I mean, I think that really falls outside my area, but I would say that there are different worlds in the art world, right? The art world isn't one world. There are many worlds. And I think you sort of answered the question yourself, which is that there is a world that of high finance and of enormous amounts of money that are moving through a global market. And for whatever reason, certain works of art are being able to tap into that. And certainly there are works, you know, we have David Hockney, right? So yeah. Hockney's his paintings is, and it's interesting. And we have, you know, and certainly Warhol's work has functioned in that way.
Jeff Koons is being sued by a lot of the people who bought his art because he's yet to produce it. So unlike Andy Warhol sort of started this idea of the factory, right, where he was paying other people to make his art and he was stamping his name on it, hence why they called it a factory. Jeff Koons has taken that one step further, and it's the term that in Silicon Valley they use called vaporware, which is right. When we sell software or hardware that has yet to be developed or created.
He hasn't finished it. Well, yeah.
That doesn't even exist yet. He hasn't even decided what the work is going to be, and he's being sued because it doesn't even exist. He's not even planning to develop it.
You mean, in other words, people are getting in line to buy it, and he hasn't produced it?
They're not getting in line to buy it. They've got in line and bought it, and they don't even know what they're buying.
Well, I don't know. I'm not really in that world. No, I really don't know. But I think that, I guess, when you go to Art After Stonewall, I think you begin to see a different notion of art making. To me, art should be that thing, I believe this as a painter, that is sort of separate from a commodity. It's that thing that you can do that isn't been taken over and sold and alienated, right? You have some control over it. It can get you through to the next day and fill you with joy and passion and express your feelings. I still really, really feel that way about works of art and all this stuff about money. And it seems to me not what I got into being a painter. Now, if I can sell my paintings for millions of dollars, I'm not going to complain, but I think it's something, it's a different thing. You know, I mean, you know, there's the writing of Shakespeare and there are the millions and millions and millions of movies and productions of Shakespeare, and somehow you want the work to have that certain integrity, a certain resistance somehow to all the different uses that it gets put to. I don't know. And certainly I think if you go to Art After Stonewall and you see the passion and the sense, here's a really important idea about the section about AIDS, is certainly what is on the line, that people's life is on the line in this work, right? People, the way that LGBTQ people are represented in the culture is a life and death matter. The way we think of a disease and how we respond to disease is a life and death matter. The way we conceptualize race and how we represent it is a life and death matter. I don't think that's the same thing that's happening in this issue of how much a work goes for in an auction house, right?
Jonathan, thank you so much for doing this amazing book and exhibition.
Well, thank you. It was, an honor, as they say. Thank you for all your wonderful questions.
Oh, it's a pleasure. I could talk with you about this all day long.
Well, you'll have to talk to me again. Come back if you have questions.
Sure.
I absolutely love it. The book is Art After Stonewall, a massive 2-venue exhibition and book that chronicles the lives of extraordinary artists from 1969 to 1989. Is now open in New York's Gray Art Gallery and Leslie Lohman Museum of Gay and Lesbian Art.
And it's coming to Miami and then going, and then it's going to end up at Columbus.
Columbus, Ohio.
Columbus, Ohio.
Honey,
yeah.
Road trip. We're right. Going to Columbus, honey. I like Columbus, Ohio a lot. You know, that's where the Arnold Fitness Expo takes place, too.
Oh, well, we should do an interview there. We should do a whole other thing.
I would great. Love that.
When will you be in Columbus?
When we'll be, I think it's in January of 2020.
Okay.
So it would be great time that maybe we can meet you in person. That would be great.
I would love that. Jonathan, you are so wonderful, and I really appreciate all the hard work. It's a thankless job, what you've done, you know, and is an insurmountable. It's a, what is that, Atlas? Is the one, no, who's the Sisyphus?
Well, Atlas Sisyphus. Carried those.
Oh, Sisyphus is the one who's trying to carry the boulder up the mountain, and when he gets to the top of it, it rolls back down to the beginning, and he sort of starts all over again.
That's like a curse. You just cursed me.
Well, no, it's just that this is it's almost an impossible task.
Yes, thank you. I really, it's at some point it felt like that, but fortunately we triumphed and it's done. And certainly many, many people worked on it, thanks to Columbus and my fellow curators and Leslie Lohman and the Gray Art Gallery. They were all wonderful. So thank you. Thank everybody.
Thank you, Jonathan.
Thank you, Jonathan.
Bye-bye.
Take care.
Take care. Bye.
Jonathan Weinberg lives in New Haven, Connecticut. Art After Stonewall, the massive 2-venue exhibition. Ooh, it's so big. is now open at New York's Gray Art Gallery and Leslie Lohman Museum. And of course, it's going to be touring.
And you can buy the book, Art After Stonewall, through the links on our website.
Or wherever fine books are sold. Mm-hmm. Support your local gay and lesbian bookstore if you have one. Or support your favorite podcast, Feast of Fun. Remember, Feast of Fun is made possible because of generous support of fabulous people like you. You can access 15 years of in-depth conversations with groundbreaking LGBTQ artists and pioneers, including some of the artists mentioned in the show. Just go to feastoffun.com/plus, and when you become a member, write to us at mail@feastoffun.com, where we can send you directions on where to, what kind of podcast you might want to listen to in our archives, because we got a lot of goodies you're just dying to stick into your portable MP3 player or smartphone.
We'll concierge some shows for you. You can also join us at Patreon at patreon.com/feastoffun and unlock our vault of goodies behind the scenes from Cooking with Drag Queens.
World of Fun.
Yeah, World of Fun. We have a new episode coming out directly with Erica Clash from season 2 of Dragula.
Now, Mark, when you were a young boy, mm-hmm. your mother took you to a lot of art galleries.
She did,
in Erie,
yes.
Pennsylvania.
Well, Erie, Pennsylvania, she was involved in some of the art museums there. But I remember one art show she did take me to was in Cleveland. It was Judy Chicago's The Dinner Party. And they had it at a...
which people usually call it the vagina plates.
Yeah, vagina plates. And it took me a moment. I was probably 10 or 12. and it took me a little while to figure it out. Now, you can see the whole exhibit at the Brooklyn Art Museum. And it's all laid out lovely, you know, on this big giant table. And they did something similar in Cleveland, but because it was an awkward space, the table kind of like winded through a couple of different rooms. But I think probably about the 20th or 30th plate, I was just like, these kind of look like vaginas. Because, you know, I was a young kid, so I didn't have much experience back then. But I'll never forget my mother signed people signed the art book or the book, the guest book when they were come. And I looked through the guest book and there's lots of people that drew pictures of vaginas and knives and forks and eating it. And then I remember my mother writing in it, you know, it's a great show, but, you know, there's more to a woman than just a vulva.
There's also labias.
Well, I'm just kind of like that she would use the word vulva of all terms. It just seemed kind of strange to me. But, you know, my mother got, you know, God bless her, just turned 94. So she was an old lady. You know, she was an old lady back then.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, a lot of people might not even get the pun, you know, which is the vagina. You're eating a vagina.
Well, I think it was maybe off it's a comment about oral sex. But I think it was also as, you know, women deserve a seat at the table.
Of power and visibility. Mm-hmm. And so that, you know, it's a wonderful, wonderful exhibition, Art After Stonewall. They're putting together some of these really legendary works of art that you can, it's one thing to look at it in a book and another thing to actually go into the art space and experience it for yourself. Yeah. You've seen, you know, Keith Haring's National Coming Out Day icon of the yellow figure coming out through the door on countless postcards and t-shirts and stuff. But to see the original painting right there and the scale of it and how it impacts you when you're standing face to face of that, you know, and certainly Fred McDarrah's photos, you know, we remember that Celebration After Riots outside Stonewall Inn photo that's so iconic and inspired movies and plays and all sorts of things of these very happy young people, a very diverse group of people celebrating their victory over the police and oppression outside Stonewall Inn. And they're ready for their selfies, you know. it's to me, it's interesting how the modern world, it was a step forward that just happened like Thanos snap instantly. Mm-hmm. And then a lot of closets just dissolved. It was like Thanos a snap for the better. Mm-hmm. You know, you had like half of the queer people in this country just all of a sudden were visible.
Well, and you think about the queer visibility before that, I would actually say probably more like homosexual visibility, right? Because you see protests in like 1965 and people, and they just look so square, right? You know, they've
got suit and ties
and, you know, their posts and stuff. And now after that, it's just people just look like everyday normal people.
You know? Yeah, they look like you could go online and search the Stonewall Inn for photos of people outside of it, and they pretty much look the same then as they do today. And that to me is like the power of Pinesol, baby. It's the ability of a transformative moment in time for people to celebrate. And I do feel, and I do worry that, you know, as Suki De La Croix says, that we're being entertained to death, that sometimes, you know, we forget that International Mr. Leather or the Pride Parades, it's not about who wins these contests or who's put on the float or who's the Grand Marshal. It's about building community. It's about bringing people together. And so if I can urge anybody who's listening to the show right now, is get out of the house and go FaceTime with some people of your own community.
And some art.
And get to the galleries, people.
Make some art.
And drink some wine.
Start a revolution. Write a manifesto.
Paint a picture. But do something. Thank you guys so much for listening. I'm Fausto Fernos.
I'm Mark Fillion.
Bye, everybody.